This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The end of Rafa, defeat to Norwich singles the end for Benitez. As that question comes round again, what's the point of Everton? Some bizarre decisions in the past week. Let your manager get rid of some backroom staff, the director of football, one of your best players, and then get rid of him. Also today, City beat Chelsea with some vintage Kevin De Bruyne. Philippe Coutinho returns to the Premier League to frustrate an already frustrated Manchester United. Leeds keep on playing games despite their injury problems. What is wrong with them? A great win at West Ham. There's a diving header at Anfield to get excited about, and some excellent James Ward-Prowse. Then we'll try and work out if the season will ever end, if teams keep getting games called off, and hope no one can see through our anti-Leicester, Liverpool, Arsenal, whoever does it next agenda. We'll cover Fulham flying, Algeria shock to AFCON, and an update on Beth and the Sussex under-14s girls final. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Cholo says, having listened to virtually every pod since 2017, including some particularly dreary ones before Project Restart, thank you, this is the best Guardian Football Weekly lineup there is, particularly Lars, providing solidity at the base of midfield with his understanding of the laws of the game. I mean, it's a huge shout. I wouldn't include any of them, but it is a game of opinions. Lars Sivertsen, welcome.
Wilson had a physical reaction to me being mis-singled out there. Can I just reveal? He couldn't. I mean, I haven't played poker with Jonathan Wilson, so I don't know if his poker face is usually any good, but I can tell the listeners in this case it failed totally.
Hey, you're in the top three of Cholo's panel, Wilson. Hopefully that is enough for you.
It's a platform to build from. Okay. Morning, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thanks. Barry Glendenning, welcome.
I presumed Wilson's reaction was to me not being singled out, as I have maintained for a long time that I am the beating heart of Football Weekly.
There was a lot going on there with what I have to say now with great confidence is my favourite Football Weekly listener. But it's made me perk up. It's made me realise I need to like sharpen up my game here now. So I guess maybe I'm motivated by praise. It seems like I'm that kind of person. Yeah, I've even taken off the hood
to see
of my hoodie.
A podcast. A podcast of the ages from Lars Sivertsen coming up, everybody. Stand back. Rob says, why are teams bothering to play fixtures? Just all agree on who the best team is and have done with it. We'll do the postponements, but we'll do them later if that's okay. We feel like we should pay tribute to the teams that actually bothered to turn up and play first. And we'll begin at Carrow Road. Norwich 2, Everton 1. Rafa Benitez sacked. The club's statement, Everton Football Club can confirm the departure of Rafael Benitez as first team manager. Benitez, who joined Everton in June 2021, has left the club with immediate effect. An update on a permanent replacement will be made in due course. Not even thank you for your service, Barry. I mean, that is brutal, isn't it?
They didn't thank him for the service. I don't think they wished him well for the future. That's clearly a sign they were displeased with him, extremely displeased with him. The club is a mess, Everton. Benitez is a symptom of the problem, but there are many other problems. I suppose Farhad Moshiri, their owner, I kind of view him like a reverse or a bizarro Mike Ashley, insofar as he's clearly ambitious. He hoses money at the club. He tries to give the fans everything they want. And the man can't do right for doing wrong. He's just everything he touches seems to crumble to dust. But it clearly, I personally thought the appointment of Benitez was a good one at the time. And he did get off to an okay start. But I'm beginning to think, you know, when you look at the list of, I think it's six managers who've been let go by Moshiri now, the club seems just unmanageable because they've tried every sort of different kind available and none of them have worked. They're in serious danger of relegation. I didn't think they would lose against Norwich. I thought it was a possibility, but I didn't really see it happening. But that's how bad they are. And Norwich are to be congratulated on ending a six-game run without scoring a goal. But I still don't give them much hope of staying up. They just beat a team that is an absolute shower at the moment.
Sam says, are we right to question how Everton are being run if they hire Benitez, who then gets rid of the head of medical, scouting, recruitment and the director of football? He doesn't get on with Luca Dean, so he's sold to Villa. Benitez then gets sacked 3 days later. So yeah, director of football Marcel Brands went, director of medical services Danny Donaghy, head of recruitment Greta Steinsen, scouting manager Dan Purdy and head of attacking fullbacks Luca Dean. They all left and then Benitez went. Wilson, people say shambles quite a lot in football, and I sometimes think they use it too quickly, but I feel like it's correct to use that word.
Yes. I mean, the Luca Dean thing, especially, that if you've got a player who, I mean, how old is he? 28, Luca Dean? So at his peak, and like clearly for a club like Everton, he is a, you know, a very good player. He is that sort of upper mid-table. Premier League is pretty much as good as you're going to get. I've got some reservations about him, but yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if I were Villa, he'd have been the person I'd have signed, because I think clubs like that probably should be signing younger. But to get rid of him and then decide 3 days later you're getting rid of the manager who is the reason why you're getting rid of him, that, I mean, shambles is the only word for that. But I just sort of feel with Everton that the whole thing's a shambles. You know, I mean, who do they get in next? Who fits? But, you know, as Barry says, they've tried every type of manager and none of them have worked. So if Koeman isn't a fit, if Marcus Silva isn't a fit, if Sam Allardyce isn't a fit, if Benitez isn't a fit, I mean, you're going to keep on appointing people who've won three Champions Leagues who disappear as soon as Real Madrid pick up the phone. I mean, that's not a way of doing things either. And that, I guess, goes to Mashiri. And, you know, there's a one of those former managers, you know, has said privately that Mashiri doesn't really know what he's doing, and he's far too susceptible to going with the whims of fans and the media.
Bob says, what practical steps can a football supporter take to make sure Mourinho to Everton happens? Paul says, if Martinez is the next Everton manager, what's the most money you've spent on ending up back where you started? The roller coaster at Legoland for me, says Paul. Lars.
I think that there's something there. I feel some sympathy for these sort of heads of recruitment who have been in position at Everton, because, as Wilson says, by all accounts, Farhad Moshiri is an owner who likes to get personally involved with some of the decision making. And obviously, you can tell from the nature of the signings, he's also given quite a bit of authority to the managers. And then the sporting director just kind of gets stuck in the middle and isn't really able to do the things that a sporting director is meant to do. So it's become like almost an impossible position that. With Benitez, I guess I maintain there was a certain logic to him. He has a proven track record of making teams more solid. If you don't have a team that's really good enough to challenge for the top four places, just trying to make them a sort of niggly, difficult to play against mid-table side. I mean, there was a logic to that. But of course, it is an exercise in how bad PR is. You know, when you have a guy who the fan base is so primed to despise from day one, you do hamstring yourself a little bit. Which brings me to Roberto Martinez, one of the leading candidates apparently to get the job. I mean, I wonder, will he last until the 30th of April? Because if he does, he will make the 6-year anniversary of Everton fans staging a sit-in protest after a game to get him sacked. Which would certainly be an occasion that should be marked. I mean, maybe they can bring cake in the press room or something. Usually if fans stage a sit-in protest, the manager isn't still there 6 years on. Now, obviously, he has taken a slight detour, but it would be a sight to see.
It has been reported that he is open to going back to Everton, but you would wonder what the motivation would be. He's the boss of Belgium. They have some terrific players. There's a World Cup looming at the end of the year. Why would you leave that quite cushy gig to take over at Everton? Presumably, it would be made financially worth his while, but I would find that a very strange move.
I mean, we know he's wealthy enough to own two tellies because he watches one at one end of the L sofa and Mrs. Martinez watches at the other L. So, you know, he doesn't need the money, does he? I mean, what about Rooney, Wilson?
I mean, Rooney's, I think, done a remarkable job at Derby. I watched their game against Reading recently. I mean, obviously, it's not easy to watch a huge amount of Championship football live. And they only drew that game 2-2, but a bit unlucky to go 2-0 down. And the way they fought back in the last 5 minutes of that game was really impressive. So he obviously has something, but having something at a club in the Championship doesn't necessarily mean that you can do it in the Premier League. You'd still worry he's slightly inexperienced. I guess he wouldn't have the Benitez issue of fans being... Yeah, fans would have patience with him in the way that they were never going to have with Benitez. If you've got the seventh highest wage bill in the Premier League and you're appointing a bloke who's got, you know, just over a year's experience as Rooney has, you know, is that a great idea? I would feel uncomfortable with that. But then again, you know, what other possibilities are there? I mean, Martinez...
This is the time. They've tried everything. It's the time to give it to some journalists who think they know best. This is our this is our moment.
I think Rooney's might be happy to stay at Derby to see the season through, because he's on the verge of doing something incredible there if they can stay up. And it's a live possibility, having had a 21-point deduction, another transfer embargo. Phil Jagielka had to leave at the weekend because they weren't allowed to re-sign him after his short-term deal ran out. But they're not without hope of staying in the Championship. Rooney seems to be thriving in that environment, and I wouldn't be hugely surprised if he wanted to stay there till at least the end of the season. You know, his time will... There will be other opportunities to manage Everton. We know that.
Really?
And he may not have to wait too long for the next one.
We should briefly, Wilson, talk about Norwich, who, like everyone else, we relegated about 2 months ago. There were people in the press suggesting they didn't even deserve to be in the Premier League or exist because they hadn't given a good enough fist of it. But look, they could survive, couldn't they? I mean, they're third bottom. Okay, they played one more than Newcastle and four more than Burnley, who may never play again. We don't know. But, I mean, a little bit of a run, it wouldn't take much. You know, Everton and us in some sort of crisis. You sort of think, you know, Watford could easily, they're only 1 point, you know, behind Watford.
The one good thing for those four teams, I mean, I think Everton will pull away, you know, and I think they would have done under Benitez, but I think just the blood sacrifice will be enough to kind of him to get another sort of 15, 16 points and survive. But the one good thing for all those four teams at the bottom, and obviously this could quickly change if Newcastle's recruitment works, is that there are three other really terrible teams there as well. So I think generally the Premier League standard is better this season than it's been for a while. You know, I think the 16th best team in the Premier League is probably the best 16th best team we've ever had. If that ends up being Everton or Southampton or Leeds or Palace or...
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, you know, they're going to be a decent side. But those bottom four are awful. So if you're Burnley, if you're Watford, if you're Newcastle, if you're Norwich, you can look at the other three and go, God, surely we're better than them. Yeah, I think Norwich could stay up because they could be better than Newcastle, Norwich and Burnley.
Of all the accolades, I think at the end of the season that managers, players, fans will be looking for, the Jonathan Wilson best ever 16th best side in the Premier League
it's like a trophy.
Is really the one. it's as good it's, as a trophy. Open-top bus ride.
It's right up there with not having to play a game in terms of that are now much like a trophy.
I mean, there's a serious possibility that 16th best team has the best player in the world ever, Salomon Rondon, in it.
We could call it the Everton Plate.
Let's go to the Etihad for Manchester City Chelsea. 12 straight wins for City. Chelsea managed just one shot on target. It did take a beautiful goal, Lars, didn't it, from Kevin De Bruyne to settle it.
He's very good, isn't he? He's good at the... Kevin De Bruyne, good at the football, more as
we
get
really
it.
He's really good at the football. Yeah. His balance and everything about it was It was vintage, wasn't
it? Yeah, and I guess I'm at severe risk of repeating myself. I think I've made this point about 5 times on the pod, but I will say it again. One of my favorite things about Kevin De Bruyne is that he's got such a range of things he can do with the ball. And you rarely see someone who, like him, he shoots brilliantly with both feet. He has a great range of passing short and long with both feet. And he's got, he's slowing down a bit now, but he's mobile enough that he can sort of, you know, go past you if you get the pacing wrong and stuff. So he's someone who, when defenders come up against him, like, there's no weaker foot to put him onto. There's no, like, you don't know if he's going to play an inch perfect through ball or cross it to someone or whip it into the top corner. Like, all of those options are available to Kevin De Bruyne, which must be such an utterly terrifying thing to come up against as a defender.
And the thing is, Lars, you could see before he took that shot, like the Terminator, you could see him surveying every single option available.
Yes.
There's deciding shooting was the most feasible one, and then promptly dispatching the ball into the far corner.
It's like a video game. He can sort of freeze time where he goes through the options to see what is the most efficient way to dispatch this now.
John says, was the BT Sports Studio criticising Kepa for the De Bruyne goal for a good 2 minutes as ridiculous as I thought it was, Wilson? And we're contractually obliged to ask if Mendy would have saved any goal that Kepa lets in, aren't we?
Well, I think you see from behind the goal that Kepa takes that little skip to his right, which means he can't get fully across. It's not right in the corner. So I don't think he's without blame. I don't think Thiago Silva covers himself in glory. But, I mean, as Lars says, it's really difficult with De Bruyne because he can go either way. But he did sort of open up that option of going on his right foot and shooting. But fundamentally, it's the pass from Cancelo which opens the space. Mm-hmm. So that's brilliant. The finish is obviously brilliant. Yeah, there's a little criticism of Kepa there, but it's just a really good goal.
What did you think of the game itself?
Well, I thought Chelsea actually, who certainly on BT got a lot of criticism for being quite cautious and quite conservative. That's how they beat them 3 times at the end of last season. They're trying to control the game. I don't quite understand why Mason Mount didn't start and why he didn't, he wasn't in either of the first 2 substitutions in the second half. I don't get that. I don't know if it was some injury or something else going on, but that seems slightly odd to me. But we weren't far off Chelsea doing what they'd done in the Champions League final, I guess the league game was a bit odd last season in that it was a bit of a dead rubber, but the cup semi-final as well, of restricting City, and you're never going to restrict City entirely, but you're doing a pretty good job of restricting them, and then striking on the break that they had the Lukaku chance, they had that opportunity when it was Ziyech who desperately overhit the pass to Lukaku, where there was a great chance of a break. There was the opportunity where Lukaku span John Stones, and then rather than going on his left foot or laying it outside to Marcus Alonso, he tried to play it through to Ziyech. He was offside and he overhit the pass anyway. So they had 3 really good opportunities on the break, or opportunities of opportunities on the break. And if they'd nicked one of them and De Bruyne hadn't smashed it into the top corner, or not the top corner, but hadn't smashed it in from 30 yards, we weren't far off being quite a different picture. So I think there's 2 things there, which are A, Tuchel trying to get some of that control back that I think Chelsea have lost recently, and B, I thought Lukaku was awful. And I think when you've been publicly critical of your manager to be that bad in a big game, I'm not surprised that Tuchel had a pop at him afterwards. I mean, he lost all 8 of his aerial duels. So on BT, Steve McManaman kept saying, well, why aren't they crossing to him? Because he's not winning it. He wasn't winning any headers. So why would you cross it?
Lots.
What I'd throw in about Tuchel's position in Chelsea, now I should stress, I think they'd be totally mad to consider his position after the season. Obviously, they've had a lot of injuries and stuff. But
of course, I would like
to just throw in there that by my reckoning and by my looking at things, 13 out of 17 seasons under Abramovich's ownership, Chelsea has either won the Premier League or sacked their manager. So it's only happened 4 times that they've not won the league or sacked a manager. In one of those cases, Mourinho left a couple of weeks into the next season. And 2 of those was Mourinho and Frank Lampard surviving, so basically club legends. And the 3rd one was Maurizio Sarri leaving by his own accord when he might well have been pushed.
Right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin at Villa Park. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Aston Villa 2, Manchester United 2. Manchester United 5 points from their last four league games. They played quite well for some of this game and then let in some goals, Barry. Do you think that's good enough? I think Rangnick afterwards said the first half hour was possibly the best half hour under his stewardship of Manchester United. You sort of sense that's not quite enough for Manchester United.
Well, not if they're not going to win games. I thought they played quite well. I thought they did enough to be more than two goals ahead when Villa launched their comeback. And, they just went all pear-shaped for them towards the end. I'm not quite sure how it all went wrong, to be honest. But Villa could conceivably have won the game, having been 2-0 down. It was very entertaining. And I will leave it to one of my learned friends to tell me how Manchester United made a pig's ear of it, a game they should have won quite comfortably. I'm very impressed with Steven Gerrard. He seems to be very good at delivering half-time rollickings, because this is not the first Villa game I've seen since he took over where they've been fairly poor in the first half and then there's been a marked improvement in the second.
To one of Barry's learned friends, Jonathan Wilson, how did Manchester United let this slip? And should actually fans go, do you know what, this is a step in the right direction, we played really well, sometimes you don't win when you play well, or is this just part of the malaise that is Manchester United?
It's obviously better to play better. I didn't think they were that much better, though. I mean, the two goals they got were both given to them by Villa. The Martinez error, and then I can't remember who gave possession to Fred. So I'm not sure United look particularly creative. They were better. And whether that's because Ronaldo wasn't there, but certainly Bruno Fernandes had a much better game than he's had for a while. But I sort of felt Villa were, so second half, I think Barry's right. I think they did improve significantly after half time, Villa. And I sort of felt they were coming back into it when Fernandes got the second. And then you sort of think, well, it's over. And the fact that they were under such pressure then, that would worry me. If I had anything to do with United. But the general malaise is clearly part of it, that I think Rangnick's been put in a... I think he's the right man doing the wrong job, that why would you bring in a coach who's only coached 88 games in the last decade when he's got an exceptional record as a sporting director? His role shouldn't be on the touchline. It should be in some backroom office organising things. If this 6 months is a fact-finding mission for him, to allow him to do that consultancy role better, well, great. But we don't know what the consultancy means. So if he's getting on players' back saying, no, you've got to press, you've got to follow this kind of quite complicated structure I've devised for you, you've got to think about the game much more, you've got to learn these whole new patterns, I kind of see why players are thinking, really? Like, what's the point of this? Because you'll be gone in 6 months. And I can imagine that being quite annoying. And it's not like these are players who don't have egos.
Presumably the point of that is because it's their jobs and they're paid quite well to do what their coach tells them to do. So maybe it's time for them to sort of shut up and get on with it a bit, would be my basic sort of fundamental position vis-a-vis Man United and their players and their egos.
And has that always been your relationship with your employers?
No comment.
Do as I do, not as I say. Bad cop Lars in charge of Manchester United.
I've also never been paid anything remotely close to what the Man United players are paid. Let me just add that. But I did think this was kind of very different in a way from what United under Rangnick have been so far. Because so far the performances have been like largely quite bad, but the results kind of okay-ish. Whereas this was, I guess, different. I did think they were better. They did run around a bit more. I thought bringing in Elanga so you have an extra forward player who runs a lot is good. Bruno Fernandes was back in a position on the pitch where he looked comfortable. It made more sense to me. But there was in the second half when it was all going wrong. I know it's slightly sort of cheap thing to say, but they could have really done with a midfielder who could come in from the bench and run around a bit. You know, they were looking short on legs. I mean, maybe Donny van de Beek coming on a minute before full time. I mean, I guess maybe Rangnick also has decided that he is not that guy. I think they need to go shopping.
Coutinho is still good at football, Barry, isn't he?
He is, yes. Brought on as a sub, scored the equaliser. That's a dream start for him. He gives Villa options where they already had a lot of options. I don't think playing Ollie Watkins and Danny Ings in the same lineup is working for Villa. It didn't work under Dean Smith, and it's not working for Steven Gerrard. I think he's going to have to drop one of them, and whoever it is will be very unhappy. I suspect it'll be Danny Ings would get benched, but that Coutinho playing in behind them, an area where Villa were already spoiled for choice, I think, and now are further spoiled for choice. But I suppose it's a nice pickle for Steven Gerrard to find himself in.
Worth mentioning Jacob Ramsey as well, who played very well. His finish was good, and his assist for Coutinho was great, wasn't it? To the London Stadium, West Ham 2, Leeds 3. Brilliant game. Jack Harrison, the first Leeds United player to score a league hat-trick against West Ham since Russell Wainscote in April 1927. Wilson, tell us about that Wainscote hat-trick, Wilson, if you would, in 1927.
Hang on, just give me a second.
Wayne's what?
Okay, all right. Well, you're just logging into one part of your brain.
Yeah.
The 1920s, here we go. Just scroll past Hungary. Scroll back a bit more. We'll get there.
I mean, Wainscote was a hat-trick specialist. Got a hat-trick on his debut for Barnsley. Got two hat-tricks when he was at Leeds. Popular figure with the fans. I think he won a cap against Scotland in 1929, his only cap. That game finished 1-0. It was a goal duck from a corner. Not scored by him, though. Left Leeds for Hull in 1931 and helped them to the Division 3 North title. Died age 69 in July 1967. So he saw England's World Cup win, which I'm sure he enjoyed.
I mean, there is always a chance, everybody, that everything Wilson says about players from this time is completely made up, because it's not like anyone can check, but he does it with such authority that I very much enjoyed that. To the present day, Lars, Jack Harrison, lovely moment, yes, for him. And he took his goals brilliant, especially the third goal. It was a lovely finish, wasn't it?
He did. And, you know, he's a player who seems to me to be quite perfect for Leeds, because I think there might be clubs where, I mean, he has certain technical shortcomings, sure, he put it quite politely, compared to the sort of very, very top level wingers. But he works incredibly hard. And that sounds like I'm damning him with faint praise. I'm really not. I mean, if you go through, it's hard to find wingers who are actually good enough to play at a very high, to a reasonably high level, and who actually work as hard as Marcelo Bielsa needs them to do. It's not easy. And he goes through an awful lot of running and has the technical quality to pull off things like the last finish was very, very good. So, yeah, good for him.
Leeds with a very weakened side. Majority of the bench made up of teenagers. Bielsa's given 8 teenagers their debuts this season. They had 2 injuries in the first, 20 minutes of this game. It's hard, given what else is, you know, given certain teams not playing games, Barry, recently, not to just be so delighted for Bielsa and Leeds.
Yeah, and I think West Ham deserve credit as well, because they've had 3 games in a week. They also have a lot of players out injured. Both teams put on a tremendously entertaining game, and it was certainly a hell of a lot more entertaining than the game that was scheduled to take place after it, which Arsenal elected not to play. Leeds and West Ham could both have asked for this game to be postponed. Neither of them did, and I think both managers deserve a huge amount of credit for that. Some clubs have been taking the piss as far as the rules are concerned regarding COVID postponements, but they elected not to, and it was an outstanding game of football. Oh, and I think Lewis Bate, he was one of the youngsters brought on the first half by Bielsa, and then he was brought off in the second half, and he looked incredibly disappointed. He was replaced by Rodrigo, but I don't think he has any reason to feel disappointed. He played very well while he was on the field, and it was clearly a sort of tactical substitution.
The other teenager who came on was Leo Yelda, who is the son of Jón Olav Yelda, who played for Nottingham Forest right towards the end of the millennium. So we have a father-son Norwegian duo who have played in the Premier League, which is lovely for us.
Congratulations to all of Norway. Should mention Jared Bowen's chest in injury time, where he arguably should have headed the ball. Always chest it down, Jared. That is the first rule of when trying to score with your chest.
Ian Wright was very critical of that. And look, Ian Wright clearly knows a lot more about goal scoring than any of us. But I just sort of thought that he had to do that because the ball was deflected and he got ahead of it. So he was sort of twisting back.
Possible.
I, I mean, yeah, as I say, I'm sure Ian Wright knows more about this than me, but my instinct was that...
Back yourself, Wilson.
That fraud, Ian Wright, who never scored a Premier League goal.
Hateful figure. He's a horrible, never smiles, never does anything. You know. it's almost as hard as starting a backlash on Ali McCoy starting on Ian Wright, isn't it? There's two complete legends.
Well, I can remember a time when Ian Wright was a very divisive figure and wasn't much liked by people outside of Arsenal, but that they were during his playing days. But I thought the deflection actually sent the ball more into his path, made it easier for him.
I just sort of thought his momentum was sort of going forward.
Barry is the heading expert, of course, on this panel. Let's go to Anfield, everybody. Liverpool 3, Brentford 0. Speaking of headers, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain's diving header. You don't see diving headers anymore, Lars. Or did you ever see them? I mean, my first instinct was, oh, brilliant. I used to see diving headers every week, but maybe I didn't.
I mean, I'd like to see some numbers on that one, Max. I don't expected diving headers.
Is that not because when in the old days Andy Gray was playing football?
Yeah.
And Andy Gray loved the diving header more than anything else in the world.
But do you think Andy Gray, he purposefully positioned himself so he'd have to dive to get to the header?
Well, his famous diving header against Sunderland in 84-5. When he's literally about an inch off the ground. He could have gone for that with his foot.
Are we saying Houchin could have Jared Bowen chested that one in and it was a mistake in 87?
No, I mean, Houchin's fair. Anyway, yeah, it was a lovely goal. It was a great cross and a very brave finish.
Are we naive to write Liverpool out of this title race now, Barry? I mean, they have a chance, don't they?
I don't think it's naive to write them out of it. No. I think even if they were to win every single game left, they still wouldn't catch Manchester City. So, no, it's not naive.
I think the bookmakers have the chances of Liverpool winning as roughly the same as Norwich for staying up. So I guess since we're all making big calls for the pod, we're relegating Norwich and counting Liverpool out of it.
Certainly not saying the chances of Liverpool winning the title are the same odds as getting 20... false positive COVID tests or whatever. it's not a road I want to go down. Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. Newcastle 1, Watford 1. Lars, have Newcastle improved under Eddie Howe?
I think they've improved a little bit, but they still, I mean, the goal, it's a very disappointing goal to concede. Like, obviously, when the points are as important as they are. You know, this is obviously a team that still they haven't done the things they want to do in the transfer market, and it has its limitations. But a cross like that into the box, you feel like you should be able to defend this, surely, given what's at stake. I mean, that was, though you have to appreciate the irony, Newcastle having just signed a magnificent crosser of the ball from the right in Trippier, they've signed a really, really good combative header in the area in Wood, and they end up conceding from a great cross from the right that's headed in by Joao Pedro, of all people. Very disappointing. I do think they've gotten a little bit better, but not as much better as you'd hoped. And certainly, it's not been a great couple of months for the theory that, you know, Steve Bruce was catastrophically underperforming with this group of players, and that really any manager at all could get a lot more out of them. That theory, I think, can be deposited neatly in the bin.
At Lars Sivertsen, just in case.
Well, and the other thing with Eddie Howe is, well, Rafa Benitez is now available, isn't he? So, say Newcastle got Leeds next weekend, haven't they? So if they were to lose that, against another team in that sort of bottom quarter of the table, then does Eddie Howe come under pressure with Benitez available? I don't know.
Maybe a bit Benitez Howe job swap could be the way to go here.
I mean, how ruthless do you think these owners are, Wilson? Anyway. I did get a really nice message from a Newcastle fan who said he felt that the pod was sort of now just baiting Newcastle. You know, it was a really lovely message. He loved the pod, but he just found it a bit, you know, he said that we weren't taking it seriously enough, or was just, you know, he was very polite about it and sort of nice, but just said it's difficult being a Newcastle fan now, you know, and he doesn't mind the talks about the takeover. And it is, I suppose it is difficult as a club if you suddenly have all the money that you become the people that people want to laugh at, I guess. That is a difficult, and that must be a difficult thing to be within all the, you know, the sort of depressing stuff about the takeover. It actually must be quite, it must be a weird situation for Newcastle fans to be in. Not the ones that yell at you on Twitter all the time, but just a normal Newcastle fan is in a weird space at the moment.
Yeah, and the sensible ones are now getting bunched in with the very loud and very unsensible ones, which I have a lot of sympathy for, actually.
I think what the problem is that quite a few of the people who are wholeheartedly behind the takeover and accuse anyone who points out the unsavoury nature of the owners, quite a few of them are prominent figures who have big platforms, and that probably doesn't help the likes of the fan who sent you the email, which I haven't seen.
Do you want me to forward all my
emails? No.
Just do that for a week and see how it goes.
I don't think we're baiting them. I just think it's funny that they're now they've got everything they wanted and everything is still diabolically bad for them.
Let's go to Molyneux. Wolves 3, Southampton 1. Wilson, that James Ward-Prowse free kick is so, so good, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Have you seen the clip of Southampton's under-9s the following day with an under-9 player? Actually a better free kick, I think, because he is with the inside of his foot, lashes it from massive distance into the top corner.
I haven't. I'm going to look at it now.
I think it's a better goal, because I think the Ward-Prowse one, there's a bit of luck to exactly how much it swerves. Whereas the other 9s player just... I mean, I don't think I could kick the ball that hard. I don't think I've ever been able to kick the ball that hard, never mind as a 9-year-old.
Oh, that is quite ridiculous, yeah. Goal A it was, by the way. I don't have the name. But for the goal that everyone else did see, the James Ward-Prowse one, I mean, technically that is... because it's so hard to control a football when you're kicking it that hard, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean... How much did he control? That would be my question. I don't like goals where the ball wobbles in the air. So Joseph Sarr, he starts to go the other way and then the ball sort of turns back. Now, is James Ward-Prowse controlling that, or is he just smashing it with a bit of wobble on it and hoping? I suspect it's the latter. And I feel uncomfortable with that. Basically, if that goal can't be scored by Russell Wainscott in 1927... I don't think it's a real goal, and I don't think you could do that with that type of ball.
Fair enough. Wolves are 8th, 1 point behind Manchester United. They also, you know, had injury problems and, you know, missing quite a few. So well done to them. Only Man City have conceded fewer goals than Wolves this season, which is a bit of a surprise. Yes, Lars?
I do feel there should be, just before we move on, should be some kind of subclause in the Premier League rules. I mean, I guess we're about to talk about rules, that if you concede a goal to both Connor Cody and Adama Traore in one game, you are immediately relegated. I'm sorry, you know, you've tried, but I mean, clearly this isn't for you. So we're going to go with someone else next season.
Brighton 1, Crystal Palace 1 on Friday night. That late own goal, Anderson's late own goal, got Brighton a point after that lovely goal from Conor Gallagher. Graham says, how good was the Palace goal on Friday night? Has there been a better team goal all season involving the entire team, Lars?
It felt very on brand for Brighton, as much as we admire them, that, you know, they played a lot and passed the ball a lot, but then when one of the teams scored an amazing team goal with a swift sort of flowing passing movement, it was the opponents. This seems to be the way it often, you know, as much as Brighton, they often, yeah. Anyway, no, it was very, very good, and Gallagher does have that sort of, he gets into the box and he's a threat. He's a very fun player. I saw someone give a stick for every time we talk about Palace, we only talk about how good Gallagher is. Yeah. But the problem is he is really good. Like, there's other good stuff going on, but it is the most eye-catching thing. But I have to say, I'm enjoying Palace's sort of transition into... I mean, this game wasn't a great example, but I think they're slowly transitioning into a team that's a lot of fun to watch. Like, any team that has both Olise and Eze on the pitch at the same time, there's a lot of vibes going on there. You know, very fun players to watch. And there's Zaha to join them as well. I think Palace have got the sort of the beginnings of a really good thing going on.
That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin by asking should teams bother playing football anymore? Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Lee says, how should we incentivize the playing of football matches? Rich says, I for one think football gets in the way of the media build-up, Snapchat filters of players, TikTok videos of fans with mega lols, bants, hysterical opinions based on something that the fan remembers from at least 3 years ago, and general over-the-top analysis. And Chris says, I find myself spending more time listening to podcasts talking about football, including the lack of it, than watching it. I can talk about Ethan Pinnock's goal of the season, but I couldn't pick him out of a lineup since I don't know what he looks like. Anyway, Burnley-Leicester was postponed. Spurs-Arsenal, of course, was postponed. Arsenal asked pretty late to have it called off. Spurs said, we're extremely surprised this application has been approved. We do not believe it was the intent to deal with player availability unrelated to COVID. We may now be seeing the unintended consequences of this rule. It's important to have clarity and consistency on the application of the rule. I mean, the Premier League, Barry, have put themselves in a very difficult situation where they allowed teams to apply for postponements. Maybe they hoped that teams would act in good faith, but now, and it isn't just Arsenal, before everyone yells, you only bring it up because it's Arsenal. It isn't. It's just, we need to play football matches, right? That's an important part of the football season, it seems to me.
I mean, it was very naive of the Premier League, and we need to remember the Premier League rules and agendas set by the 20 teams who were in the Premier League, so it's self-governing. But it was very naive of them to think that clubs wouldn't push their luck when they were invited to apply for these postponements. Arsenal fans have got very angry, saying that people only got exercised about it when they asked for a postponement. But I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And there's no doubt in my mind they could have fielded a team to play Spurs yesterday. I believe they only had one or possibly two COVID cases in the squad, and the rest was down to injuries, AFCON absences, and the fact that they loaned out two players last week. But yeah, clubs were always going to take the piss. And Arsenal elected not to play their game yesterday, and their fans, who presumably got into football because they like watching football, are emphatically defending their team's right not to play football. We don't want to see them play. It smacks of cowardice to me, not least when you see clubs like Leeds and Wolves and West Ham, among others, happily sending out teams and not even applying for postponements because their managers or hierarchy have a bit more integrity than those of other clubs.
I mean, if you saw how Spurs played against Chelsea in the Carabao, I'm amazed they didn't just think anybody could have, you know, given Spurs a game. But
it is important to remember that Arsenal have not broken any rules. They've just stretched them to the absolute limit.
Sure. And look, I'm sure lots of other teams, clearly some teams are dealing with this in different ways to others, but a lot of other teams might have tried the same thing. I guess the point is now something has to change because the season won't end. If people keep postponing football matches, surely the Premier League have to get around a table, Wilson, and say, okay, we need to rethink this because otherwise the season will not finish and there's no wiggle room.
Yeah, I mean, there's two problems. So the first is the lack of clarity, that I still don't understand why some teams have had applications turned down and some teams haven't. But there's also, it's not just the point of getting the games on. Arsenal are in a race for fourth with Tottenham, with Manchester United and with West Ham. Now, it doesn't affect Tottenham because they're now out of Europe. But Manchester United are still in the Champions League and West Ham are still in the Europa League, or Europa Conference League, sorry. So for them to rearrange fixtures is much harder than for Arsenal. So Arsenal gained an advantage by not being in Europe that I think is not entirely fair. Now, that's not saying, again, that Arsenal have done anything necessarily wrong or necessarily immoral, but the situation is not the same for them as it is for West Ham. And I think that's why David Moyes was so irritated this week, that he clearly felt by having had to play Norwich midweek, his team was then tired playing Leeds yesterday. Whereas, you know, Arsenal do have three midweeks later in the season because they don't have European football. So I think that I mean, people talk about the integrity of the league, and there's a whole load of inbuilt unfairnesses that you can't really do anything about. You know, in the old days when you regularly had frozen pitches and people didn't have undersoil heating, and you would often get pile-ups at the end of the season because of that, or when you had replays in the cup, that's just a thing that happened, and get on with it. But this does feel like it's just not a particularly helpful regulation. And yeah, if the regulation's there, why not take advantage of it? I don't particularly blame Arsenal for it. I just think the regulation is unclear and not great. And it was presumably brought in to stop the spread of COVID. And it, so if it's being enforced for teams who only have one or two COVID absences. Now, I know, again, Arsenal have said that a lot of their injuries are because they had to play players more over Christmas because they had COVID then, which is something that I don't feel medically qualified enough to comment on. But was that why the regulation was brought in? And why do Leeds never use it? Why are Leeds just playing teenagers all the time? Do they feel that's beneficial to play the teenagers? And, you know, Arsenal played an under-23 game on Friday,
I think it was.
So if it can put out an under-23 team, really two or three of them can't step up?
Clubs aren't obliged to dip into their under-23 sides unless the players are appropriately experienced, which means they've played one senior match for Arsenal or some other Premier League or Football League club.
And actually, that's an interesting point, because that has been beneficial for teams who haven't given opportunities to young players earlier in the season. But if you happen to give an under-23 player a game, like bring him off the bench to blood them, because we all love one of our own, we all love footballers playing, then suddenly they become an experienced player. And all, like, whether you played 5 minutes, an hour, or none, you're still an under-23 player with almost no experience. I mean, it's... do you think, Lars, and I've seen some people saying this is an example of why there needs to be an independent regulator, is that taking this too far or not?
I just think they needed to have a bit of a think before they set these guidelines in place. I mean, true to form, I'm actually looking at the sort of guidelines as they were published on the Premier League website now. And you're right, the line is where a club cannot field 13 outfield players and a goalkeeper, either from its squad or its appropriately experienced under-21 players, the match will be postponed. But you're exactly right. I mean, that basically punishes you for giving appropriate experience to the youngsters that you have. And it also kind of, if you have a couple of squad players lurking around who are a bit rubbish and you rather not use them, you should send them the hell out of the club, you know, because if you just loan them out somewhere, then you can have the game postponed if it doesn't suit you to play. Like it is like you said earlier, like the way it's worded, it's way too easy to take advantage of, and it's the unintended consequences of it have been very clear to see. Like, again, I think we've all said the point isn't to jump up and down on Arsenal's heads here. This is a rules problem, not an Arsenal problem. But put it very simply, was this these rules intended to for a team that has one COVID case to get games postponed? I mean, that clearly wasn't the intention when they sat down and formulated these rules. And it doesn't make any sense.
And if you look at Leeds, I don't know how injured Adam Forshaw and Junior Firpo are, but say, for the sake of argument, they're out for 3 months each. In electing to play yesterday with a load of kids on the bench, Leeds had to bring on Lewis Bay and Leo Helda, and now they are appropriately experienced, which means they're further hamstrung as far as future games are concerned, because they have these appropriately experienced kids who've played, you know, less than one game each.
And not to mention, you know, not every Arsenal and Tottenham fan live in North London, right? Some, you know, you plan travel to go to games. There's the businesses involved. I mean, the result is not really the most important part of a football match, right? The whole point is you get to, you know, we missed football. We couldn't go to football, and then it was behind closed doors. And now you can go to football and you can't go to football because it's been postponed. And then you're happy about it being postponed. Fucking stupid. Anyway, AFCON, excuse my language. I don't know why. I don't know what happened to me there. Reigning champions Algeria beaten by Equatorial Guinea, Wilson. Esteban Obonna. He was delighted when he scored that goal, wasn't he?
Oh, he had a brilliant game as well. So Algeria had gone 35 games unbeaten. So they were two behind the record held by Italy. I think Brazil have gone 36. So Algeria were level with Spain when Spain lost to the US in the Confederations Cup semi-final in 2009. So you know, this is a really good Algeria side. And Equatorial Guinea held, not only held them, but actually plays pretty good football. And I go as far as to say that, well, okay, there was a bit of a siege last sort of 20 minutes, half an hour. But certainly that first hour, you could make a case Equatorial Guinea with a better team. And you had this astonishing sort of last 10 minutes. Well, I just can't remember seeing anything like it for years, of sort of four Algerians standing on the halfway line, waiting for the ball to get cleared to them. And Equatorial Guinea having just all the ball in the Algeria half, and these sort of five defenders not being able to get it off them, to the point where Equatorial Guinea started doing back heels and flicks. And if they'd been sensible and just taken the ball in the corner, they could have held, they could literally have had 100% possession for the last 10 minutes of that game. But they got a bit carried away and had a couple of shots, which gave Algeria possession back. But still, now we should say the pitch in Douala is horrendous, which didn't help Algeria, who, you know, I think are a team who passed the ball nicely. But still, this is an astonishing result. And now they have to play Cote d'Ivoire and probably win that game to have a chance of going through.
And Ivory Coast drew with Sierra Leone. It was an injury time comeback. I mean, it was hilarious and sad, actually, the look on the goalkeeper's face. He's injured himself, sort of dropped the ball. I think the pitch might have had something to do with it.
Oh, it's completely the pitch.
Definitely.
So it was very like, I mean, people who remember Simon Jones' terrible injury in Brisbane, it was very like that. The pitch was obviously very soft. His knee sort of, because basically he's trying to stop, he's trying not to concede a corner, lunges after the ball, gathers it, and then his knee gets lodged in the pitch and he's sort of flipped over and the ball sort of squirts out from under him because he lands on top of it. And then Sierra Leone, you know, ball's crossed in the middle by Stephen Colker, and the forward has slipped on the terrible pitch, and somehow, because he slipped, that throws the defender and allows him to sort of scoop the ball over the defender. So it's a great result for Sierra Leone. But yeah, Sangare, the keeper, he's only playing because Gubahu, the first choice, failed the drugs test last week. So the poor lad ended up going off on a stretcher. Whether that was a sort of face-saving, my knee's actually really badly hurt, or whether he is really badly hurt, either way, I really felt for him because it was the pitch, it wasn't him, and he's been absolutely slaughtered for it. So now, I mean, Ivory Coast have got 4 points, haven't they? So they should have enough to go through, but they could put Algeria out. If they draw that final game, then Algeria, I mean, depends what happens between Equatorial Guinea and Sierra Leone, but Sierra Leone have 2 points, Equatorial Guinea three. If they were to draw, Algeria would have to win. And even then, even if Sierra Leone were to lose, 2 points might not be enough to get through as the best third place team. Probably wouldn't be enough.
I had only just switched on to watch the end of this, and I had a real Barry Sergio Ramos at PSG moment with this, because I saw the goal as it happened. And I have to say, you know, watching Ivory Coast Sierra Leone and for the goalkeeper to have this unfortunate moment, Stephen Colker was not the player I was expecting to be lurking near the goalkeeper, just for many reasons, just because he's a centre-half, but also because I wasn't aware of his Sierra Leonean heritage. Apologies. But what a great adventure for him. That must be a terrific thing.
We should also say in that Ivory Coast game, the first Sierra Leone goal by Moussa Camara was a brilliant goal. Such a good goal. Just a little sidestep and then absolutely lashes it in the top corner. So, you know, they scored one brilliant goal and one slightly freakish goal. But I actually think, you know, Cote d'Ivoire did miss a couple of chances and they missed a penalty. But still, again, Sierra Leone were well worth the point.
Should also mention Arise Sajourie ended up in goal. Because, you know, the most defensively sound he's been in his entire career. Anything else caught your eye, Wilson?
Well, Ghana in trouble. That's the other thing. Because they lost their opening game to Morocco. They then were 1-0 up against Gabon. Alevina equalised 2 minutes from time. And there was a fantastic brawl in which there was a sensational left hook and a red card. So Ghana now only have 1 point. So they're in a position not dissimilar to Algeria, except they are playing Comoros. So if they win that, they'll be on 4 points. That might take second if Morocco beat Gabon, but 4 points probably will take you through as the best third place team. But they now have to beat Comoros.
All right. Finally, Boubacar says, how did Beth get on this weekend? M. White says, setting aside the Prem, how is COVID impacting Europe's top competition, the Sussex under-14s girls final? You remember Werbenek got in touch to ask Barry to slate Beth in a sort of Jordan Ayew, Iheanacho style to see if it would help. Werbenek has been in touch. We still don't think it's actually Bill Werbenek. Hi, Max. Beth and her team with Dean Youth FC were buoyed by Barry's good luck charm, but unfortunately they came up against a superb Lewis FC Academy side from the tier above who just shaded it 6-0. They had a great day out playing at a ground with advertising hoardings. Oh, a snack bar and a tannoy announcer. And she was very amused by the mention on the pod once I'd explained why there was a grumpy Irish bloke from her dad's podcast piling into her. I'm hugely proud of her and the rest of the team. She showed precisely the right level of rueful disdain at her runners-up medal. Thanks for the mention. While I'm here, thanks for all you do on the pod, which has been beneficial to my mental health in the last 2 years in the same way much more eloquent people than me have already described. Look, thank you, Bill Werbenek, and commiserations to Beth. Barry, do you want to...
But hang on, isn't Barry a co-owner of Lewis?
Yeah, I was about to say, as a shareholder in Lewis, I wouldn't have given Beth the pep talk if I'd known she was playing against their academy.
Well,
so,
you want to rub her nose in it now?
I am delighted Beth and her teammates got tonked. And fair play to Lewis. The future is clearly bright.
All right, that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Lars.
Thank you so much. It was good fun today, Max.
Oh, God, you brought your A game, though, as you promised.
I'm not sure that's true, but I'll take your word for it.
On the greatest performance on a podcast of all time now, and we were there to witness it. Jonathan Wilson, thank you.
Thank you.
Barry Glendenning, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm delighted to say that Liam McClare has begun making loops of us again with his musical prowess. I was on his dad's podcast, The Life of Brian McClare's podcast. If you want to listen to me repeat the three anecdotes you already know. very kind of Liam to make some loops. So here we'll play out with it. This one's starring Troy Townsend. We're back for a Europod tomorrow.
But it's an unfair platform. It infuriates. Think it should be in the competition. I don't know if we're going to discuss that at all today, but it's an unfair platform. It infuriates. Think it should be in the competition. I don't know if we're going to discuss that at all today, but it's an unfair platform. It infuriates. Think it should be in the competition. I don't know if we're going to discuss that at all today, but it's an unfair platform. It infuriates. Think it should be in the competition. I don't know if we're going to discuss that at all today, but it's an unfair platform. It infuriates. Think it should be in the competition.
This is The Guardian.